At Queen Esther's request, all of the Jews of the capital city of Susa there in the Persian Empire spent 3 days in fasting, which, as I mentioned last week, is always accompanied by prayer in the Old Testament Jewish pattern. That's a huge indication here in this book that does not name God explicitly, that He is indeed there. He's squarely in the middle of this whole thing. He is in the hearts of the people and in all the details here, though He's not mentioned by name. Esther and her ladies-in-waiting have also been fasting and praying during this time, but this had to be done in the seclusion of the king's first harem. She was not free to go and join the others, though that would not necessarily have been a good thing at this point, because in the story to this point in the narrative, it's likely that her ethnic identity as a Jew is still hidden, both to the king and certainly to Haman, and that would be a good thing at this point because Haman is the enemy of the Jews, and he would quite naturally have his suspicion aroused by Esther. But at the end of this 3 days' time, at the end of this fasting, Esther acts in a very bold and decisive manner, and that's where we pick up today. In Esther chapter 5, beginning with the first verse, hear the word of the Lord. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room, opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter, and the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleased the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them. And tomorrow I will do as the king has said." The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of the Lord does live forever. Now, if you remember in this story up to this point, unless a person was actually invited to this place in the palace, the innermost throne room, then that person uninvited would and usually was executed. And part of the reason for that, of course, was this, to stop assassins from approaching the king there. But the other aspect, I believe, would be to add to the divine authority of the king, his semi-godlike status in the Persian Empire. The king of all people cannot be approached unless he invites you. The historical record notes that guards surrounded the throne with axes, waiting and watching for interlopers, unless the king gave word and made the gesture with the royal scepter to that unannounced visitor. Those guards would descend on the uninvited visitor in short order with axes in hand. Well, the beautiful Queen Esther is one of those uninvited visitors on that day. She, who was picked among all the other young women in the kingdom as the highest wife of the mighty King Ahasuerus, she adorns herself to make this risky approach. It's noted what she wears, which is certainly relevant. It's the royal robes. She may and probably did have clothes that were more beautiful or alluring or suggestive. than these robes. But the robes had been given to her by the king. They were official state garments, and they were a visual reminder of who Esther was as the first lady. And that certainly would make any guard hesitate or pause, and it would gain the king's attention. There would be no doubt about who she was. It was a wise move on her part. And when the king saw Esther, he indeed allowed her, he condescended to her to approach him. And he held out the scepter to her, and she touched it, is what I'm sure it was a very grateful acknowledgement of the king's grace upon her. So that was part number one of her plan, just simply to survive, to get close enough to the king to talk to him. Mission accomplished, she was alive. But the king wasn't simply tolerant that day. He seemed to be in an especially benevolent mood, if we read between the lines. Listen what he says, and then he repeats it later on. "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom." That's not just saying, "What's wrong? What? Spill it. Let me hear it." He is especially in good humor. That's generous. "I've never had anyone offer me half of their kingdom before. I am waiting for that day, as I'm sure you are. Never happened to me." It sounds like a cliche. It probably is. Something like when we'd say, "I'll do whatever you need." Will you really do whatever I need? It sounds like that kind of royal cliche. Nevertheless, it's indicative of a very generous mood that he is in. Perhaps that's a coincidence. I think it's more of that God working behind the scene in this whole story. God put him in this especially good mood today. Well, what does Esther ask of the king? If it were one of us and we were just going into this thing, we might blurt it out, right? We might just spill our guts there and get it off our chest and tell what the problem is. Does she do that? Does she blurt out her alarm over this edict, which will result in the extermination of all the Jewish people if it's carried out? No, she doesn't. She invites the king to a very special feast that she's prepared for him, and she also asks that Haman would attend. I'll remind you who Haman is. He's the second in command in the whole empire, and he is also the arch villain in this story. He is called Haman, the enemy of the Jews. He's the one that convinced the king to sign this edict in the first place. He didn't even tell him that they were the Jewish people. He just said, this little small people, they're troublemakers. They don't do what you say. I think we should get rid of them. He's a conniving, hateful weasel. He's the arch villain of the story. Now, of course, this invitation would have been a great honor to Haman. Just think of that, to dine at a private banquet with the king of the empire given by the queen. The queen is going to prepare and serve the food just for the two of us. It doesn't get much more prestigious than that. It's like winning one of those contests for a backstage pass to your favorite musician, and once you get back there, he or she sits and talks with you personally for about 15 minutes, times 100 when you get to sit with the king and be served by the queen. It's a big deal. Well, the two men come promptly to the feast that Esther has prepared. Apparently, they enjoy themselves. They're lounging around, imbibing afterward. And again, the king asked generously to fulfill Esther's request, even up to half the kingdom he will grant. Certainly, this is the invitation she's waiting for. I'll tell him now that the mood is right. How does she answer? She asks him back for a feast on the next day. The food and the atmosphere must have been fantastic. The king says yes. But also, think about what Esther's doing. She's creating some suspense. Some tension there, some importance. She's raising the importance level of her request. Certainly the king would pick up on this. It must be big if she's doing this again. And I've enjoyed today. I'm going to come back tomorrow and I'll listen to her. And also, we've seen him act quite nicely for him in this passage. We must assume that he's at least partly concerned for his favorite wife, that he cares for her to some degree. So the stage is set. The next day, Esther's going to lay it out there. And the conditions seem favorable for the king to oblige her in whatever that favor is. The mood is right. But there's still a night to go through. So we'll see what happens next week when they meet for banquet number 2. There's an old adage that says, what a difference a day makes. That is very true. It could turn bad very quickly in the space of 24 hours. It often does. But what I'd like to consider with you today is just how Esther got to this promising point. It wasn't a given by any means. After all, the king had banished the previous queen, Vashti, just because she wouldn't submit to parading around in front of his drunken governors. He was a man of questionable character and certainly a sketchy worldview. And I want to talk to you a bit about worldview. Some of you know what that is. I'm going to assume that some of you do not. So I'm going to explain worldview for a moment. Your worldview is your overarching philosophy of life. It's everything in your understanding. That recipe, for instance, contains your values, your history, your expectations, your attitudes, and your beliefs. Your worldview affects and informs all your thoughts and all your actions to some degree. For instance, in the traditional ancient religion of Japan, Shintoism, their worldview revolved around ancestors. Their ancestors were venerated. That means in part worshipped. And every aspect of one's behavior revolved around honoring those ancestors and not bringing a perceived dishonor upon the family name, even if it meant taking one's own life in order to prevent doing so. So in that scheme, for instance, it was dishonorable for an individual to surrender because it not only dishonored the nation, it dishonored their family. How did that play out? Well, for instance, in the Great Battle of Okinawa, some of you have heard of that. Some of you have heard of it from your fathers or uncles or grandfathers. One of the biggest battles of World War II, in the last months of World War II, way out there on a little island, over 100,000 Japanese troops survived, and by the historical accounts, there were less than 100 prisoners taken. This was because that underlying worldview of ancestor worship was primarily why so few survived, because many thousands of Japanese soldiers committed harikiri rather than be captured. It also didn't help that the Japanese leadership had convinced all those soldiers that the Americans would eat them if they captured them. That was also part of the dynamic as well. So their worldview was in play here. It was a horrible thing. That was their worldview, though. Esther's worldview is also in play. And we see that her worldview is centered upon God. And so she, before entering into this critical, dangerous mission of hers, she stops for 3 days to fast. And she asks the whole Jewish people in her community to fast with her, to participate. Even before that 3 days, though, she was at a point of resolution. Because last week, remember, she said, if I perish, I perish. If I perish, I perish. So be it. In other words, she would face this with the strength of God no matter what. Whether she lived or died, she'd be okay. She believed that because her worldview was centered upon Yahweh. No, she wasn't perfect. She met this at first with timidity. She was a little scared. What can I do? But her worldview, as it swung back into focus, was grounded upon God. He who created heaven and earth, He who had saved her people in mighty ways in the past and promised His loved ones, those who turned to Him in faith and belief, good things, promised good things, even a good eternity. Esther could be at peace then because God was with her, whatever happened. Contrast that with, for instance, the king's worldview, one which was very focused on earthly things, on beautiful women, on the conquest of nations. Remember, he'd fought this huge battle and probably lost, if history's true, on increasing his treasury, on his power and standing. As I mentioned before, we have a lot of extra biblical information on this man and his kingdom. One of the ancient historians who documented his life was Herodotus. And he records this particular episode when King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes as he's called in the Greek, you've probably heard that name, he was reviewing his troops, all of them in the vicinity. They were laid out before him in rank and legion, and he initiated a rowing match with the boats, you know, rowing. And here's what is recorded about that. Afterwards, his uncle, Artabanus, was surprised to find Xerxes weeping. He asked the reason. "I was thinking," Xerxes replied, "and it came into my mind how pitifully short human life is. For of all these thousands of men, not one will be alive in 100 years' time." True and very true. The king did not have the peace of existence, of human life, that comes from knowing God, either here or for the life to come. If he knew that about the men, he knew that about himself. And he was weeping because of it. His worldview reflected what he believed about death. In Esther's worldview, Yahweh was in control. And so she needed to seek God's direction and favor before she acted. She did so, and then she could take comfort whatever happened. She needed to seek God's favor, because she then knew that she had sought to please God in this, and that was most important. But she could also take heart that He would guide and direct her into what she should say and do, and perhaps that would lead to favor with the king, who would then be able to reverse somehow this terrible edict that he had made that loomed over the entire Jewish people. We certainly already see the marks of God's favor in this story. We see this unity of purpose among His people, for instance. I know we go through a story and we mention something. How wonderful a thought of all of the believers in a whole city coming together for 3 days and fasting and praying. We've never seen anything like it in our time. Imagine that. What if we did that? What if all the true Christians in this country stopped for 3 days and gathered in large groups all over the country and fasted and prayed? I wonder how God would answer that. I bet it would be remarkably. But if nothing else, it would give us renewed faith and confidence as His church. If nothing else, it would give us renewed focus as His people. Imagine that God is already showing favor there just by having them have the heart to gather together and seek His will. But we also see details of favor in Esther's plan, even down to the clothes she wears, to the choices that she makes there. God's favor includes wisdom in some pretty tricky situations. which we all encounter from time to time. Certainly his favor includes lightening the mood of the king that day. God can do that, you know. He can work in our minds and hearts to affect us. Here he is. He's gracious and condescending to Esther. And she doesn't wisely does not just rush into telling him what she wants. She continues to foster goodwill with the king, to throw Haman off guard, for one. Haman's not suspicious of something going on. And she gives time for God to work out other details. That one day, well, all sorts of things can happen in a day. And we'll see that in next week's passage. So Esther gains God's favor, and in turn she even gains the king's favor up to a point. No, it doesn't always work this way, of course. When we seek God's favor, we don't always gain the favor of man. During some of the bloodiest persecutions of the Roman Empire, the middle part of the 3rd century AD, a man named Cyprian lived. He was made the bishop of the Church of Carthage. That wasn't a favor back then. It was a mark of death to be a bishop, to be the leader of a church in a community. He was caught up in the arrest of many other Christians, and it was demanded of him to turn over the names of the other leaders, of the other Christian leaders. He refused. He did not curry the favor of man, of the emperor. He did not. The fact is that all he had to do to escape punishment was to turn that list over and to eat food that had been sacrificed to idols and say a prayer in the name of the Roman gods. He did not do that. He did not curry favor. Instead, he used his time before execution to preach Christ. It is said that at his execution, he knelt in prayer. He gave his executioner a gift. Have you ever heard of such a thing? In other words, he blessed his executioner in some way, and then he placed the blindfold on himself. He was compliant and agreeable. What a message he sent. But he surrendered to God in that. He sought God's favor. God gave him favor in the way that God chose, and that was to take him to himself. He did not seek the favor of man. So we don't always gain that favor when we seek the Lord's. We don't always get both. That shouldn't be the motive anyway, should it? We shouldn't be about the business of people-pleasing. A Christian worldview starts and ends with loving God the Father and the Savior He sent, and seeking with all our heart and mind and strength to serve Him and Him alone. We should always seek His favor. Brother Paul said it best, "For me to live is Christ and to die is gain." Everything in our worldview should be about God. And if we need to recalibrate, which we all do from time to time, then do so. It's all about God. Everything here is passing quickly. It does not last. I'm amazed at how quickly the years go flashing by. Young people, it does not last. God builds us for eternity and prepares a place for us there. He's who we are to be focused on in everything we do. But His mission for us always includes other people. It's never just about us and Him. That's not the world He placed us in. It always includes us sharing the gospel in word and in action. It always includes living peaceably as far as it's concerning you with everyone. Everyone. It also means being salt and light in this world, defending the gospel and forwarding and advancing the gospel. We're always about other people. That's what He's done. He's put us in the world, right? And this often requires the favor of others. And so here's a lesson for us here, I believe, to to pray for that, to let God direct us in how to wisely interact with others, and in part for their benefit. How to effectively share the gospel, for instance. Not just blurt it out. We talked about this briefly in Sunday school this morning. But to know how to weave it in. To know how to effectively present the gospel in a conversation so that it can have the best chance of piercing the heart. To look for opportunities to be aware. Most notably, when you've established a relationship of love and trust with someone, even in some small manner. It requires the favor of others. We need to try to cultivate the favor of others. We're not setting ourselves up to be the pariah of the community, the most difficult person we know. We're setting ourselves up to be able to communicate with others, and that requires kindness, currying their favor. Or knowing when and how to ask for something important, as Esther exhibited here, as she modeled here. I don't mean for a new set of chrome rims or a vacation to Tahiti or wherever it is you want to go to. But for something that's important for the well-being of yourself and others. How do you ask? When do you ask? Do you ask without regard for the person to whom you're making the request? Do you just bull right in on whatever given moment strikes your fancy without regard for whether that person is worn out from a long day's work or in a foul mood or struggling themselves with some big issue? Do you just go ahead and ask regardless, just thinking of yourself and your needs and your wants? Or do you have a care for them in their moment? Do you pray and prepare and bide your time? This is not sneaky, by the way. It's not some trick to play. Not when we're talking about issues of physical and spiritual well-being. It's wise. It's wisdom. It's wisdom from God. And God often can and will provide insight on how to interact in difficult situations, giving you the means and methods for the problem to be dealt with in a favorable way with the person involved. You can apply this to spouses, to bosses, to folks at school, to all sorts of people. How do I deal with them? How can I do my best to make it a favorable interaction for them? But again, it doesn't always work out that way. And we can't always seek to gain favor with other people. First and foremost, we're to seek God's favor in everything we do. Because when we have that, in reality, we have all that we need. His favor. We can live peacefully and peaceably then. And even die confidently when that day might come. So may you live in search of that favor of God. Not your comfort, not your perceived safety, not to be everybody's friend in life, but seeking to find His direction for it. And being blessed with that peace that helps us say, what will be, if I perish, I perish. But I do so living for Jesus. May it be so for you. Amen.